People have a hard time believing when I tell them that I played high school football. Their eyes go up even higher when I tell them that my senior year, I was a starting right tackle. This is a true story. And I've got the scar that looks like a map of the London Underground on my left knee to prove it, where four guys bigger than me landed on it and busted it all to pieces. When I explain to people that I was a little bigger then, it makes a little more sense. I was about 85 pounds heavier in high school. And I have trimmed up a little bit since then. But I can remember as vividly as though it were yesterday, during the spring of my sophomore year, during spring training, when I met Gene Foster, my football coach. I was terrified of him, if only by reputation. He was five games shy of his 300th win going into the fall of my junior year. And he was not a man to be messed with. He had a reputation for expecting a lot from his players. And he was intense. That's probably an understatement. Every Monday afternoon, we ran what were called gassers. Sprints back and forth across the field sideways four times. And the question was never, were you going to lose your cookies? It was, how many gassers would it take? Because we would run them until every member of the squad had lost their cookies on the side of the football field. If you don't know what that means, just ask a friend. We don't want to be too graphic here. He also was a brilliant man. I've known a lot of athletic coaches who were coaches first and teachers second. But he also was quite the academic. He went to his undergraduate degree with a football scholarship, but for his graduate degrees, he received master's degrees and teaching certificates in five different science disciplines, and he went to college with a National Science Foundation grant for those degrees, and he was a fantastic science teacher. I had him my junior year for chemistry and my senior year for physics. And before that, I met him on the football field. So there we were, first day of spring training. I really only played football because all of my friends did it. The second part of the story, not only was I 85 pounds heavier than I am now, is that my school was pretty small. We had a graduating class of 67. So it was pretty easy to get a starting position. But my sophomore year, all the guys were bigger than me. I had never met this man face to face, never spoken to him, never shook his hand. I only knew that there was a certain terrifying expectation of judgment coming. And there we were, the first 10 minutes of football practice, stretching out. We'd do that for 10 minutes. We're on the ground. We'd stretch this way and that way and the other. And I couldn't reach very far because everything got in the way. And finally, he said, we're going to stand up and start doing some sprints. So we sort of got up slowly. And from across the football field, he yells my name at the top of his lungs with this just terrible clanging ring in his voice, as though I had killed his mother, Matt Johnson! And every head on the field looked at me, what's he done? And Coach Foster said, I thought I told you to stand up. And the whole team just roared with laughter. And it broke the tension, and I thought, okay, this guy's going to be okay. And we had a lot of fun with Gene Foster. Even though I got to know him very well over those next couple of years and grew very close to his family, he passed away just a few years ago, and we called his wife and still do to this day Mama Foster. I never quite lost the sense of dread and performance anxiety on Gene Foster's football field. And that was good. I tell you that story because there is a sports metaphor or symbol that is used to begin the discussion that ends with this expression in Hebrews chapter 12. For our God is a consuming fire. In Hebrews chapter 11, we get a brilliant picture of the heroes of faith, as the Hebrew writer calls them, men of old. Of course, there were women in that list as well, but that's a generic expression that he uses. Men of old, who many of them, most of them, all but Enoch, of course, died not having received the promise that we have since received. And the Hebrew writer describes these men of old as a great cloud of witnesses, as though they are now the audience that has gone on before. They have received the victor's crown, the laurel crown, and they are gathered as the audience around us in the great arena. And now we are running a great race. And in that race, Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1 tells us, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Anybody here ever play sports? Raise your hand if you played a sport. Or, raise your hand, anybody here play a musical instrument? Or do theater? Raise your hand if you've ever done any theater. Or any other kind of event where other people came to watch? Just wouldn't raise your hand. So, imagine for just a moment if you were involved in your event of choice. You're playing football, and in the stadiums around you are every single Super Bowl ring wearer who is alive or ever had lived. They'd been resurrected and they're sitting in the stands. Every college national championship winner, whoever was, every football Hall of Famer who ever lived, and they are the ones peopling the stands in which you're playing this football game. Imagine if you're a musician and you're going to do a recital. And Pavarotti is sitting in the stands. John Philip Sousa, Mozart, Bach, Brahms, Beethoven, they are the individuals sitting in the audience waiting for you to play the first note. Imagine for just a moment you're playing a Broadway show and all of the great Broadway stars are there. Barbara Streisand is sitting in the audience. Chaim Topol is there. He played Tevye on Broadway and in the film and in tours just very recently. All over the world he's played that role. And Tony Award winners left and right sitting in the audience watching you perform your high school version of the Music Man. And they're just waiting. And they're cheering you on. Would that make you a little nervous? That's the picture that the Hebrew writer paints for us. And I believe that the kind of perhaps fear and intimidation that comes from that sort of performance anxiety is a really positive thing. Read with me, if you will, the end of Hebrews chapter 12, because there's some language in here that I think today in our culture, in our religious world, we are uncomfortable with. There's an image that's painted here in this section. A comparison between a couple of mountains of old, Mount Sinai and Mount Zion, and the spiritual mountains on which we live spiritually, the Hebrew writer says. And he paints this picture for us beginning in verse 18. You have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further message be spoken to them, for they could not endure the order that was given. If a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. An exciting image. The promise that you have given. The rest that you have been given. The victory that you have been given. The Hebrew writer has been arguing throughout the book. The sacrifices that have been made for your salvation, more permanent. The founder of the house, a better founder than the founder of the house of Moses. For Moses was a servant in the tabernacle. Jesus was the architect. A better mediator than angels or priests of old. Because he is God incarnate, the exact representation of his nature. Far superior is what we have than any generation of man has ever known in terms of promises, redemption, salvation, revelation, access to God. And it's not just a representation. It's real. It's palpable. It's genuine. And the thought that we have the ability to walk onto that mountain in the midst of this great cloud of witnesses should give us a sense of awe. But there's another side to that coin. A warning. And the Hebrew writer sprinkles warnings throughout this book. The greatest of those, which we'll turn to in a moment, is in Hebrews chapter 10. But he follows that up with this, beginning in verse 25. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. For this phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of the things that are shaken. That is, things that have been made in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. He says the place of promise is great, and it is a place that will not be shaken, but it can only be described as that which cannot be shaken in comparison to all else, which will be shaken loose from its very foundations. And the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter both make it very clear that what is meant by that is that all that we see and all that we know in the physical universe will at some point in the future be burned up. It will be destroyed. And like the men and women of old who stood outside the closed doors of Noah's Ark and witnessed the destruction of the world around them and saw just a few fleeing to salvation in that boat. So if we are lost, we will, in the great day of judgment, look at the world that is being destroyed and we will be held in the hands of God with fear and a certain expectation of judgment that should shake us to our very foundations. I have an inclination that that's not a thought we're very comfortable talking about in the 21st century. In fact, I was in a Bible class at a different place, in a faraway land, which will go unmentioned, in which I sat through a Bible class where essentially they erased the fear of the Lord and said, well, what's meant by fear of the Lord when the Bible talks about it is respect. And of course, we want to have respect for God and we should have respect for our elders and respect for our parents. But God doesn't want us to be fearful. And so I want to unpack this idea this morning for just a few moments and ask the question, what is meant when we talk about the fear of the Lord? How should we understand it? How should we grapple with it? Because there are a lot of things that we're afraid of. And we have, I think, this misunderstanding of the term fear that creates a lot of confusion when we look at biblical fear of the Lord. So let's be clear about this for just a moment. The Greek language, and even the Hebrew language, which isn't always as precise as maybe even English, but both the Greek language and the Hebrew language are very precise in their conceptions of fear. In both the Old Testament and the New Testament, when we read about the fear of the Lord and the fear of judgment, the words are clearly understood by translators universally as dread, terror, and awe. There's no confusion about what those terms mean. When the Hebrew writer uses a word that translates fear, he means terror and dread. It can't be confused with the word meaning respect. And dread is good. Dread is a good thing. I dreaded Gene Foster. Not because I thought he was going to destroy me. Well, that's what I thought at the very beginning. When he yelled my name from across the football field, there was a certain terrifying expectation of judgment. I thought I was ended. I was off the football field. He was going to humiliate me. I was never going to be good enough because I had disappointed him. And so that was it for me. I was terrified. And whereas I came to realize that Gene Foster was a brilliant encourager and exhorter of men, he was a maker of men. He was a champion, by all definitions of the word. But he also created an attitude and an atmosphere of mutual respect amongst the young men on his team. And yet, every time I walked onto his football field, there was a sense of butterflies in the stomach. There was a performance anxiety and a need to extend myself so that I wouldn't let that man down. And that is a healthy kind of dread. Dread tells us who we are and who God is. In fact, it tells us who we are because of who God is. Romans chapter 1 tells us that the whole problem of sin derives from not acknowledging who God is and elevating the created things above the position of the Creator. Because we don't have a proper sense of dread for who He is, what He did, and who we are in reference to Him. And when we hold people in a sense of awe, it is not at all emotionally damaging to us. My father's 73 years old. He is, although he wasn't until very recently, about an inch and a half shorter than me. And I think probably as the years go on, although I'm not growing, I'm probably going to gain at least another half inch or three quarters on him. Because, of course, he's starting to diminish a little. And he's got arthritis in his knees, and his back goes out every once in a while. And he can only work for 3 or 4 hours out in the field. When I was young, he'd do it for 16. Come home, hang out with the kids, sleep for 3, drink a cup of coffee, then another, and he'd go out and work for another 16 hours. And probably, if we were to look at just the biological realities, I might be able to pull one over on my dad. If we got into fisticuffs. But the fact of the matter is, I'd be scared to try. Because what I make up for in youthful vigor, he overcomes in old man crotchetiness and terrifying meanness. And I I just have this sense that if I roughhoused with my dad, even though he's 73, that he'd embarrass me in front of my children. And I think that's healthy. And even with a PhD and a pretty good job and a fair set of life accomplishments, there's still this nagging sense every once in a while, if I catch a glimpse in their eye the wrong way, that makes me just want to double check, am I making mom and dad proud? And I think that's healthy. You've probably had a boss before that you worked for who you didn't want to disappoint. Not because they were a terror and they were mean to you and they wanted to make your life miserable, but just because you knew that they were a person of excellent character and accomplishment and you didn't want to put a toe wrong. You probably, young people, have had a teacher or somebody who you respected, maybe even an older college student who you looked up to, and there's certain kinds of behaviors or things that you might say that would be, if you set them around people that you respected, silly and embarrassing, and you just changed the way that you joked, and you changed the way that you behaved, and you stepped up your game when those cool people walked into the room because you cared what they thought about you. And that kind of awe, reverence, which is much more than respect, is good. And that's what we mean when we say the fear of the Lord. Dread, terror, awe. Not just respect, the way that we've diminished it, I think, in the 21st century. A kind of respect that says, Dad is just my buddy. He's a friend. We're peers. I'm just as good as anybody else. There's a reason that whether they've earned it or not, the Old Testament says we ought to rise up before the gray head. And that we ought to respect an office. And the New Testament tells us we ought to respect the government, whether we agree with their positions politically or not. Because that's what a Christian does. Gives respect where respect is due. Counterpoint to that is often made from 2 Timothy chapter 1. In which the Apostle Paul, telling Timothy, you've been given a great gift. I've taught you things. Your mama taught you things. Your grandma taught you things. And I'm giving you a reminder to make sure that you take advantage of all the gifts that you've been given and the talents that God's blessed you with. And don't let that diminish, but fan the flame and work harder. And don't miss out on opportunities. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 6, for this reason I remind you to fan into flame the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For, verse 7, God gave us a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control. And a lot of folks turn to this passage and they say, see there, the New Testament says that we're supposed to be free of fear. Or we could turn over to the letters of John where we read that perfect love casts out fear. And so we ought not to have fear. Fear was an Old Testament concept. But love and faith are New Testament concepts. And terror, dread, awe of the Almighty has been erased in the New Covenant. Well, I don't want to just run to Greek definitions to make my argument here. But we'll start with this first because I think it is an important place to start. You remember I said, and you can look this up because the folks who know these things have written about it pretty consistently, and you'll find that those Hebrew and Greek words for fear are dread, terror, awe. This is a different concept in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. The New American Standard translation, I think, more accurately renders this expression, God has not given us a spirit of timidity. Some translations render it cowardice. And the word there indicates that we have not been given a spirit that shrinks back, that is cowardly, that is timid. And there is a difference between fear, which is a state of emotional experience or an intellectual response to a set of stimuluses that is natural, and timidity, which is a behavioral response. You've probably been fearful at many points in your life when you weren't timid. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands in here. How many of you guys are afraid of roaches, spiders, or rodents? Because I don't want to embarrass you in front of your sweetie. But men, have you ever had to kill something that terrified you just as much as it did her, but you did it anyway because that's our job? Or climbed a ladder when you were afraid of heights because you didn't want to be embarrassed around the people who didn't know you were afraid of heights? Or gone out for football when you were the chunkiest monkey in all of the sophomore class because all of your friends did it and it was the cool thing to do, and your physical coordination was such that if you had ended up in a position where they were throwing a ball to you, you probably would have lost an eye and broken a nose, and you were really glad you were on the line because you never had to touch the ball and all you had to do was just get in the way, sort of spread out. My junior year, the guys who lined up across from me on that line were the size of Buffalo, New York. We had a guy on our football team who went on to play college football only because he was a good football player. I'm not sure how they explained away his GPA, but this guy could go head to head with a freight train. And I remember the first time in a scrimmage, he ran into me. Both of my ear pads popped off and came out of the helmet. My helmet flew off the top of my head, and it felt like a firecracker, not one of those little ones, but an M50 had gone off inside my sinus cavities, and I couldn't see straight for a half an hour. And I stood up, and because all of those guys who were older than me were making fun of me, because we had this was long before hazing was illegal, let me tell you. And I knew that if I showed a moment of weakness, if I blinked, they would eat me alive. And after about 4 weeks of abuse, they said, "I think Johnson likes this." I hated every minute of it. But from that moment on, they were my protectors and my friends instead of my tormentors. But there wasn't a day for those first 3 weeks that I wasn't terrified of what I was doing, because I didn't have a clue. And I will confess to it, I've never told anybody this except for my older brother. There was a moment when, in a fit of ignorance, I had to go home and look up in the Encyclopedia Britannica some of the rules that I didn't quite understand, because I never watched football when I was in junior high. But I didn't let that stop me. And I'm sure that you haven't let it stop you either. And what the Hebrew writer is telling these Hebrew Christians who are beginning to be persecuted, probably by their own brethren for their faith, is, look, I know it's terrifying, it's frightening, but don't shrink back. You are not of those who shrink back. That is a different kind of fear. Paul is telling Timothy that God hasn't called us to cowardness, but to boldness. He says, He hasn't given us a spirit of fear, but He's made us powerful. He loves us. And He's given us self-control, or some versions render that He's given us discipline, which also connects with what Hebrews chapter 12 says. We didn't read this passage, but, and I don't want to spoil it, because we're studying this in the teen 3 class right now. And so we're going to talk about discipline next week, guys and gals. But this is the analogy that we began with. The Hebrew writer says, your earthly fathers disciplined you. You have to discipline yourself if you're in a sporting event. Don't despise the discipline of God. Don't let it make you fearful and cowards. Be afraid of the Creator in a positive way, and understand that you need to really be afraid if you shrink back from Him in negative ways. Because see, there's two kinds of fear. There's a fear that steals your joy and steals your victory. And there's another kind of fear that spurs you on to victory, that gives you courage and boldness. And it's an accurate and a worthy response to the God of heaven. who holds you in the palm of his hand. We might well say, in fact, that there are three kinds of fear. There is a fear that the Hebrew writer talks about that is spawned from shame and guilt. And we have, each and every one of us, experienced that kind of fear. Centuries ago, an old preacher by the name of Jonathan Edwards, who preached a sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. We'd never preach that sermon today. In which he describes the human race, those who are outside the grace of God, who have not been washed and cleansed and purified by the sacrifice of Christ, held in the hands of God like an offensive spider, whom God, only because of his patience and forbearance and hope for the horrific creature, does not crush it in his wrath or drop it into the fire. Sinners in the hands of an angry God. And we outside the grace of God, or if the Hebrew, as the Hebrew writer says, those who have tasted the grace of God but then reject it, can suffer from that kind of fear. And when God says he sets us free from fear, that's what he's talking about. He sets us free from shame and humiliation. A good analogy, I think, for it is the language of the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 6, when he says, we've been set free from slavery unto what? Unto slavery. He says, look, there's no question about it. We're going to be slaves. We can be a slave to sin, unto humiliation and destruction and fear and shame, or we can be a slave to God, unto liberty and victory and usefulness. What kind of slave do you want to be? And then the Hebrew writer likewise says, we can have fear, the fear of shrinking back, the fear of sinfulness, which leads to destruction, or we can have the wholesome and awe-inspiring fear of the Almighty, which spurns us on to dignity and work and value and victory. And on that note, a second kind of fear is a fear that stems from doubt. The Hebrew writer, the Apostle Paul, John, all tell us that kind of fear is not a valuable fear. A kind of fear that says, I just don't know if I can do it because I'm not good enough. And actually what we're saying when we say that is, I don't know if I can do it because I don't know if I believe that God is good enough. Do I have a fear of being able to do what I'm being asked to do? Are you waiting to become a Christian because you're fearful that you won't be able to live a life that's good enough? Are you fearful of confessing sins that are eating you and your family and getting the help of elders here who want to help you and Christians who want to pray for you because you're so afraid that it will destroy your life even though you know you need to get help? Or you're so afraid that you'll never be able to turn around and change directions or become free from the shackles that bind you? You don't know how to lay aside those encumbrances and those weights of sin. Are you fearful that you can't overcome those addictions or those challenges because you just don't know if you're strong enough? The Hebrew writer says, cast your eyes on the King, the Captain, the Redeemer, who gives us the power to overcome. Know that he's done it first, and that a great cloud of witnesses surrounds you. They've done it. He aided them because of their faith, and you can do it too. And then, the third kind of fear, which is that healthy fear. The awe of the one who is able to wipe away the terror of the others. And so my message for you this morning is a simple one. A healthy dose of the fear of the Almighty is the greatest gift that mankind has ever been given. I believe that not only after their sin in the garden, but before, when Adam and Eve walked unclad in the presence of God, that they must have looked at Him, their Father, their Creator. And like a small child, still innocent from the womb, looks at his father and mother, must have gazed up into his eyes, thinking, who is this great one who walks and talks with me and provides for me every step of the way? And it is the loss of that looking up at the majesty of one who is so far beyond us that we can't even begin to grasp who they are and where they've been and what they've done and how we could ever become what they are. That is what Jesus was seeking when he said, "Suffer the little children to come to me, for if you want to enter into the kingdom of heaven, you got to become like them." We're going to sing a song in just a moment to encourage you. If you're not a Christian here this morning, we want to encourage you to escape from fear. To give yourself over to a very different kind of dread. The dread of a God who made you, who expects from us so much. And we will never meet those expectations. But in striving to do so, because we love Him and we're in awe of what He is and what He's made us capable of, we'll make Him proud. And He Himself will complete the work for us. He already has in the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Will you subject yourself to Him in awe and fear and reverence and in joy and in release? Then we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing.